In 1944, 11 years before her fateful decision on a Montgomery bus, Rosa Parks was investigating a vicious crime. As an emissary for the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, she had traveled to rural Alabama to meet with Recy Taylor, a young woman who had been sexually assaulted by six white men. It would be difficult enough to convince an Alabama court that even one of these men was guilty, but Rosa was undeterred. She formed a committee to defend Recy in court, flooding the media with testimony and sparking protests throughout the South. When a jury failed to indict the attackers, Parks demanded the governor assemble a new grand jury. She wrote, "I know that you will not fail to let the people of Alabama know that there is equal justice for all of our citizens." Throughout her life, Parks repeatedly challenged racial violence and the prejudiced systems protecting its perpetrators. But this work came at an enormous risk and a personal price. Born in 1913, Rosa was raised by her mother and grandparents in rural Alabama. But outside this loving home, the fear of racial violence cast a long shadow. The Ku Klux Klan frequently drove past their home, and Jim Crow laws segregated public spaces. At 19, she settled in Montgomery and married Raymond Parks, a barber who shared her growing fury at racial injustice. He was involved with the local chapter of the NAACP, a role many avoided for fear of persecution. At first, Raymond was eager to keep Rosa safe from the potential dangers of activism. But as she grew more incensed at the limitations imposed on African Americans, she could no longer stand by. When she officially joined the NAACP in 1943, Parks and Johnny Rebecca Carr were the only women in the Montgomery chapter. She began keeping minutes for their meetings and soon found herself elected secretary of the chapter, formally beginning her secret double life. By day, Rosa worked as a seamstress to support her mother and husband. By night, she researched and documented numerous civil rights cases, from local policy disputes to high-profile murder cases and hate crimes. As secretary, she prepared public responses on behalf of the Montgomery chapter, battling the harsh sentencing, false accusation, and smear campaigns frequently used against African Americans. In addition to her legal work, Parks was a brilliant local strategist. As advisor to the NAACP Youth Group Council, she helped young people navigate segregated systems, including voter registration and whites-only libraries. Through the cover of the NAACP, Parks strived to bring clandestine civil rights activities into the open. She advocated for civil disobedience training and spoke out against racial violence, particularly the murder of Emmett Till. In 1955, her refusal to move to the back of a segregated bus helped ignite the grassroots movement she had hoped for. Parks was arrested and jailed for her one-woman protest, where she was visited by local activists. Together, they planned a 24-hour bus boycott. It lasted for 381 days. Parks' simple act had transformed nascent civil rights activism into a national movement. In 1956, the boycott ended when the Supreme Court ruled in favor of desegregating public transport. But this victory for the movement had come at a great cost. Rosa had been receiving vicious death threats throughout the campaign and was unable to find work in Montgomery because of her political reputation. In 1957, she moved to Detroit to continue working as a seamstress until being hired by Congressman John Conyers to help support his burgeoning civil rights campaigns. Ever vigilant in the fight against racial inequality, Parks remained active for the next 40 years. She wrote several books, traveled across the country giving talks to support other activists, and established an institute for the education of young people in her late husband's memory. Today, Rosa Parks is remembered as a radical spirit. In 1944, 11 years before her fateful decision on a Montgomery bus, Rosa Parks was investigating a vicious crime. As an emissary for the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, she had traveled to rural Alabama to meet with Recy Taylor, a young woman who had been sexually assaulted by six white men. It would be difficult enough to convince an Alabama court that even one of these men was guilty, but Rosa was undeterred. She formed a committee to defend Reese in court, flooding the media with testimony and sparking protests throughout the South. When a jury failed to indict the attackers, Parks demanded the governor assemble a new grand jury. She wrote, "I know that you will not fail to let the people of Alabama know that there is equal justice for all of our citizens." Throughout her life, Parks repeatedly challenged racial violence and the prejudice systems protecting its perpetrators. But this work came at an enormous risk and a personal price. Born in 1913, Rosa was raised by her mother and grandparents in rural Alabama. But outside this loving home, the fear of racial violence cast a long shadow. The Ku Klux Klan frequently drove past their home, and Jim Crow laws segregated public spaces. At 19, she settled in Montgomery and married Raymond Parks, a barber who shared her growing fury at racial injustice. He was involved with the local chapter of the NAACP, a role many avoided for fear of persecution. At first, Raymond was eager to keep Rosa safe from the potential dangers of activism. But as she grew more incensed at the limitations imposed on African Americans, she could no longer stand by. When she officially joined the NAACP in 1943, Parks and Johnny Rebecca Carr were the only women in the Montgomery chapter. She began keeping minutes for their meetings and soon found herself elected secretary of the chapter, formally beginning her secret double life. By day, Rosa worked as a seamstress to support her mother and husband. By night, she researched and documented numerous civil rights cases, from local policy disputes to high-profile murder cases and hate crimes. As secretary, she prepared public responses on behalf of the Montgomery chapter, battling the harsh sentencing, false accusation, and smear campaigns frequently used against African Americans. In addition to her legal work, Parks was a brilliant local strategist. As advisor to the NAACP Youth Group Council, she helped young people navigate segregated systems, including voter registration and whites-only libraries. Through the cover of the NAACP, Parks strived to bring clandestine civil rights activities into the open. She advocated for civil disobedience training and spoke out against racial violence, particularly the murder of Emmett Till. In 1955, her refusal to move to the back of a segregated bus helped ignite the grassroots movement she had hoped for. Parks was arrested and jailed for her one-woman protest, where she was visited by local activists. Together, they planned a 24-hour bus boycott. It lasted for 381 days. Parks' simple act had transformed nascent civil rights activism into a national movement. In 1956, the boycott ended when the Supreme Court ruled in favor of desegregating public transport. But this victory for the movement had come at a great cost. Rosa had been receiving vicious death threats throughout the campaign and was unable to find work in Montgomery because of her political reputation. In 1957, she moved to Detroit to continue working as a seamstress until being hired by Congressman John Conyers to help support his burgeoning civil rights campaigns. Ever vigilant in the fight against racial inequality, Parks remained active for the next 40 years. She wrote several books, traveled across the country giving talks to support other activists, and established an institute for the education of young people in her late husband's memory. Today, Rosa Parks is remembered as a radical spirit. In 1944, 11 years before her fateful decision on a Montgomery bus, Rosa Parks was investigating a vicious crime. As an emissary for the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, she had traveled to rural Alabama to meet with Reese Taylor, a young woman who had been sexually assaulted by six white men. It would be difficult enough to convince an Alabama court that even one of these men was guilty, but Rosa was undeterred. She formed a committee to defend Reese in court, flooding the media with testimony and sparking protests throughout the South. When a jury failed to indict the attackers, Parks demanded the governor assemble a new grand jury. She wrote, "I know that you will not fail to let the people of Alabama know that there is equal justice for all of our citizens." Throughout her life, Parks repeatedly challenged racial violence and the prejudice systems protecting its perpetrators. But this work came at an enormous risk and a personal price. Born in 1913, Rosa was raised by her mother and grandparents in rural Alabama. But outside this loving home, the fear of racial violence cast a long shadow. The Ku Klux Klan frequently drove past their home, and Jim Crow laws segregated public spaces. At 19, she settled in Montgomery and married Raymond Parks, a barber who shared her growing fury at racial injustice. He was involved with the local chapter of the NAACP, a role many avoided for fear of persecution. At first, Raymond was eager to keep Rosa safe from the potential dangers of activism. But as she grew more incensed at the limitations imposed on African Americans, she could no longer stand by. When she officially joined the NAACP in 1943, Parks and Johnny Rebecca Carr were the only women in the Montgomery chapter. She began keeping minutes for their meetings and soon found herself elected secretary of the chapter, formally beginning her secret double life. By day, Rosa worked as a seamstress to support her mother and husband. By night, she researched and documented numerous civil rights cases, from local policy disputes to high-profile murder cases and hate crimes. As secretary, she prepared public responses on behalf of the Montgomery chapter, battling the harsh sentencing, false accusation, and smear campaigns frequently used against African Americans. In addition to her legal work, Parks was a brilliant local strategist. As advisor to the NAACP Youth Group Council, she helped young people navigate segregated systems, including voter registration and whites-only libraries. Through the cover of the NAACP, Parks strived to bring clandestine civil rights activities into the open. She advocated for civil disobedience training and spoke out against racial violence, particularly the murder of Emmett Till. In 1955, her refusal to move to the back of a segregated bus helped ignite the grassroots movement she had hoped for. Parks was arrested and jailed for her one-woman protest, where she was visited by local activists. Together, they planned a 24-hour bus boycott. It lasted for 381 days. Parks' simple act had transformed nascent civil rights activism into a national movement. In 1956, the boycott ended when the Supreme Court ruled in favor of desegregating public transport. But this victory for the movement had come at a great cost. Rosa had been receiving vicious death threats throughout the campaign and was unable to find work in Montgomery because of her political reputation. In 1957, she moved to Detroit to continue working as a seamstress until being hired by Congressman John Conyers to help support his burgeoning civil rights campaigns. Ever vigilant in the fight against racial inequality, Parks remained active for the next 40 years. She wrote several books, traveled across the country giving talks to support other activists, and established an institute for the education of young people in her late husband's memory. Today, Rosa Parks is remembered as a radical spirit.
Captain Kirk, otherwise known as William Shatner, is scheduled to blast off tomorrow on a quick trip to the edge of space and back. He'll board Blue Origin, the space company founded by billionaire Jeff Bezos. But who gets to fly to space and why? NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce has the story.
The first space travelers had to have the right stuff. They were military pilots. But when NASA's space shuttles began flying in the 1980s, all kinds of VIPs started lobbying to go as passengers. A task force decided that flying a non-astronaut would be okay for public education purposes. So in 1984, President Ronald Reagan said he was directing NASA
to choose as the first citizen passenger in the history of our space program, one of America's finest, a teacher.
NASA created a Citizens in Space program. It was managed by Alan Ladwig. He remembers going on David Letterman's show to talk about it.
And I said the first spaceflight participant program would be the teacher. Well, the very next day, when I got back to D.C., I read the Washington Post, Jake Garn's flying in space.
Who was Jake Garn? A senator who chaired the subcommittee that oversaw NASA's budget. He got NASA to fly him on the space shuttle, as did another member of Congress, Bill Nelson, who now leads NASA. Both went up before the space shuttle Challenger disaster in 1986. That accident killed the whole crew, including the teacher, Krista McAuliffe.
There was some criticism out of Congress, some media, that, well, this just shows space is too dangerous for an ordinary citizen.
Ladwig says NASA canceled a planned journalist in space program, and after that, it only flew professional astronauts. Well, except for John Glenn. He was a former astronaut, the first American to ever orbit the Earth. At the age of 77, when he said he wanted to fly again, NASA made an exception.
I mean, the media turned out in droves for that mission. The public loved it. He's a national hero, was a national hero.
For people who weren't astronauts or national heroes, the only option for years was paying millions of dollars to Russia. Its space agency sold trips to space stations, to a TV journalist from Japan, a bunch of businessmen turned space tourists, and, just last week, an actress and movie director. Now, though, Russia has competition from U.S. companies. Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin both offer short flights that have minutes of weightlessness, and SpaceX has a capsule that can orbit the planet for days. In recent months, these firms have taken a motley assortment of people to space, what Saturday Night Live called random weirdos.
First mate Jeff Bezos' brother, whose name escapes me. Science officer, some rich high school kid from the Netherlands. And 82-year-old astronaut, Wally Funk.
Just days after this Star Trek-themed parody aired, Blue Origin announced it was taking up Star Trek actor William Shatner. The 90-year-old will be the oldest person to reach space. He's reportedly going as the company's guest.
I do think it's classic marketing.
Joe Chabosky is an associate professor of public relations and marketing at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He says when a new product makes a splash, like the first Blue Origin flight did this summer, companies have to figure out how to keep the public's attention.
William Shatner makes sense in that here's a celebrity that made their claim to fame on like traveling space. And it's like a one-time kind of kitschy branding opportunity.
But he says, even though celebrities get headlines, this runs the risk of just reinforcing a perception that's already out there, that spaceflight is just for the famous or ultra-wealthy. One seat on Blue Origin's flight was auctioned off for $28 million. Chabosky thinks it's in the long-term interest of space companies to make sure their flights also incorporate scientists and people who don't have deep pockets.
Captain Kirk, otherwise known as William Shatner, is scheduled to blast off tomorrow on a quick trip to the edge of space and back. He'll board Blue Origin, the space company founded by billionaire Jeff Bezos. But who gets to fly to space and why? NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce has the story.
The first space travelers had to have the right stuff. They were military pilots. But when NASA's space shuttles began flying in the 1980s, all kinds of VIPs started lobbying to go as passengers. A task force decided that flying a non-astronaut would be okay for public education purposes. So in 1984, President Ronald Reagan said he was directing NASA
to choose as the first citizen passenger in the history of our space program, one of America's finest, a teacher.
NASA created a Citizens in Space program. It was managed by Alan Ladwig. He remembers going on David Letterman's show to talk about it.
And I said the first spaceflight participant program would be the teacher. Well, the very next day, when I got back to D.C., I read the Washington Post, Jake Garn's flying in space.
Who was Jake Garn? A senator who chaired the subcommittee that oversaw NASA's budget. He got NASA to fly him on the space shuttle, as did another member of Congress, Bill Nelson, who now leads NASA. Both went up before the space shuttle Challenger disaster in 1986. That accident killed the whole crew, including the teacher, Krista McAuliffe.
There was some criticism out of Congress, some media, that, well, this just shows space is too dangerous for an ordinary citizen.
Ladwig says NASA canceled a planned journalist in space program, and after that, it only flew professional astronauts. Well, except for John Glenn. He was a former astronaut, the first American to ever orbit the Earth. At the age of 77, when he said he wanted to fly again, NASA made an exception.
I mean, the media turned out in droves for that mission. The public loved it. He's a national hero, was a national hero.
For people who weren't astronauts or national heroes, the only option for years was paying millions of dollars to Russia. Its space agency sold trips to space stations, to a TV journalist from Japan, a bunch of businessmen turned space tourists, and, just last week, an actress and movie director. Now, though, Russia has competition from U.S. companies. Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin both offer short flights that have minutes of weightlessness, and SpaceX has a capsule that can orbit the planet for days. In recent months, these firms have taken a motley assortment of people to space, what Saturday Night Live called random weirdos.
First mate Jeff Bezos' brother, whose name escapes me. Science officer, some rich high school kid from the Netherlands. And 82-year-old astronaut, Wally Funk.
Just days after this Star Trek-themed parody aired, Blue Origin announced it was taking up Star Trek actor William Shatner. The 90-year-old will be the oldest person to reach space. He's reportedly going as the company's guest.
I do think it's classic marketing.
Joe Chabosky is an associate professor of public relations and marketing at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He says when a new product makes a splash, like the first Blue Origin flight did this summer, companies have to figure out how to keep the public's attention.
William Shatner makes sense in that here's a celebrity that made their claim to fame on like traveling space. And it's like a one-time kind of kitschy branding opportunity.
But he says, even though celebrities get headlines, this runs the risk of just reinforcing a perception that's already out there, that spaceflight is just for the famous or ultra-wealthy. One seat on Blue Origin's flight was auctioned off for $28 million. Chabosky thinks it's in the long-term interest of space companies to make sure their flights also incorporate scientists and people who don't have deep pockets.
Captain Kirk, otherwise known as William Shatner, is scheduled to blast off tomorrow on a quick trip to the edge of space and back. He'll board Blue Origin, the space company founded by billionaire Jeff Bezos. But who gets to fly to space and why? NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce has the story.
The first space travelers had to have the right stuff. They were military pilots, but when NASA's space shuttles began flying in the 1980s, all kinds of VIPs started lobbying to go as passengers. A task force decided that flying a non-astronaut would be okay for public education purposes. So in 1984, President Ronald Reagan said he was directing NASA
to choose as the first citizen passenger in the history of our space program, one of America's finest, a teacher.
NASA created a Citizens in Space program. It was managed by Alan Ladwig. He remembers going on David Letterman's show to talk about it.
And I said the first spaceflight participant program would be the teacher. Well, the very next day, when I got back to D.C., I read the Washington Post, Jake Garn's flying in space.
Who was Jake Garn? A senator who chaired the subcommittee that oversaw NASA's budget. He got NASA to fly him on the space shuttle, as did another member of Congress, Bill Nelson, who now leads NASA. Both went up before the space shuttle Challenger disaster in 1986. That accident killed the whole crew, including the teacher, Krista McAuliffe.
There was some criticism out of Congress, some media, that, well, this just shows space is too dangerous for an ordinary citizen.
Ladwig says NASA canceled a planned journalist in space program, and after that, it only flew professional astronauts. Well, except for John Glenn. He was a former astronaut, the first American to ever orbit the Earth. At the age of 77, when he said he wanted to fly again, NASA made an exception.
I mean, the media turned out in droves for that mission. The public loved it. He's a national hero, was a national hero.
For people who weren't astronauts or national heroes, the only option for years was paying millions of dollars to Russia. Its space agency sold trips to space stations, to a TV journalist from Japan, a bunch of businessmen turned space tourists, and, just last week, an actress and movie director. Now, though, Russia has competition from U.S. companies. Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin both offer short flights that have minutes of weightlessness, and SpaceX has a capsule that can orbit the planet for days. In recent months, these firms have taken a motley assortment of people to space, what Saturday Night Live called random weirdos.
First mate Jeff Bezos' brother, whose name escapes me. Science officer, some rich high school kid from the Netherlands. And 82-year-old astronaut, Wally Funk.
Just days after this Star Trek-themed parody aired, Blue Origin announced it was taking up Star Trek actor William Shatner. The 90-year-old will be the oldest person to reach space. He's reportedly going as the company's guest.
I do think it's classic marketing.
Joe Chbosky is an associate professor of public relations and marketing at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He says when a new product makes a splash, like the first Blue Origin flight did this summer, companies have to figure out how to keep the public's attention.
William Shatner makes sense in that here's a celebrity that made their claim to fame on like traveling space. And it's like a one-time kind of kitschy branding opportunity.
But he says, even though celebrities get headlines, this runs the risk of just reinforcing a perception that's already out there, that spaceflight is just for the famous or ultra wealthy. One seat on Blue Origin's flight was auctioned off for $28 million. Chbosky thinks it's in the long-term interest of space companies to make sure their flights also incorporate scientists and people who don't have deep pockets.
So Rome and London had six gates, and we're at the first of them here, Old Gate. You can see the Church of Old Gate behind me. The gate was somewhere around this junction, which they're remodelling at the moment, so we can't see the precise spot. But this was the gate that led out of London towards Colchester, the important Roman town. And today it's still a very straight road, you know, Whitechapel Road, Mile End Road. You can still see it's Roman. This gate was called Old Gate, not because it was the oldest gate. People now think it was because it's the Ale Gate. There was some kind of hostelry, or what we'd now call a pub, outside the gate. And that's where the name Old Gate probably came from. They will never know for sure. The other interesting thing about this gate, Geoffrey Chaucer, the early English writer, lived inside the gate during, I think, the 14th century. So we're now at our second gate, which is Bishop's Gate. You can see behind me the Heron Tower is more or less on the site of that old gate. This was the Roman road that led out towards East Anglia, and again, it's still Die Straight today. It's what we know now as Shoreditch High Street, Dalston, it goes on to Stoke Newington. We don't know who the bishop is that Bishop's Gate is named after. It's perhaps Erkenwald, who was this Anglo-Saxon figure who was very famous in the 7th century. Great thing about Bishop's Gate, it's the only London gate to be mentioned in a Beatles song, and I'll leave it with you to see if you can work out which song that was. We're now standing at Moorgate. Now, this was not one of the proper gates of the city in Roman times. This was very much a back door to the city, or a postern, to use the technical term. It was only built up as a major gateway in the medieval times. It led out into marshland called Moorfields, and those marshy lands were caused by the wall itself. Moorgate connects with London Wall, which we see down here. London Wall, of course, named after the ancient Roman wall. And today, again, it's becoming something of a wall. These modern buildings, London Wall Place, that are springing up as we speak, are giving the road a very characteristic enclosed feel to them. So once again, we see London Wall re-rising. Well, we're now at Cripplegate, probably the least known of London's gateways. Cripplegate also has this very evocative name. You think of cripples, people begging for money. That may well be the way the gate got its name. There was a kind of church and almshouse around here where cripples may well have come to beg. But it may also be from the Anglo-Saxon word cruple, which means a kind of subterranean vault or passageway that might have been in the area. Historians are divided. Like all the other gates, there's no remains here today. There is this nice plaque, though, which you'll find similar versions at most of the gates, and it tells you how to walk the Roman wall. And I invite you to come along anytime you like and walk this route. It's very clearly labelled on these maps, and get your own feel for the size and scope of the Roman city. Well, we're now on the site of Aldersgate, not to be confused with Oldgate, despite the similar name. Aldersgate is probably named after an Anglo-Saxon landowner, Mr. Alders or something like that. No one really knows, as with so many of these gate names. The name Aldersgate still survives today. If you go beyond the Museum of London back there, you'll be on the modern-day Aldersgate. And indeed, the Barbican Tube Station, which is just over that way, used to be known as Aldersgate Tube. Welcome to Newgate, and despite its name, it's just as old as all the other gates dating back to Roman times. Now, Newgate is quite a famous Roman gate, probably because of the jail which grew up here in the Middle Ages. Newgate Jail, it's just behind us now, the Old Bailey complex. And Newgate itself, the actual gate, did have prison cells within it, and that's where the old prison came from. And behind me, you might be able to see St. Sepulchre Church. Now, that's full name is St. Sepulchre Without Newgate. Without meaning outside the gate. So it all kind of fits together. We're on the site of the old gate, the church was out, and the prison is within. So here we are on Ludgate, one of the great famous entrances into London, and you can see why with St. Paul's at the top of the hill there. There are many explanations for where this name comes from. It may have been named after King Lud, an ancient king of London who may or may not have existed. Or Lud may have been a corruption of Floodgate, referring to the fact that the River Fleet is just down at the foot of the hill there. It may have flooded the area from time to time. Again, nobody really knows where the name comes from, but it's still a marvellous spot to finish our tour of the gates. So Rome and London had six gates, and we're at the first of them here, Old Gate. You can see the Church of Old Gate behind me. The gate was somewhere around this junction, which they're remodeling at the moment, so we can't see the precise spot. But this was the gate that led out of London towards Colchester, the important Roman town. And today it's still a very straight road, you know, Whitechapel Road, Mile End Road. You can still see it's Roman. This gate was called Old Gate, not because it was the oldest gate. People now think it was because it's the Ale Gate. There was some kind of hostelry, or what we'd now call a pub, outside the gate, and that's where the name Old Gate probably came from. They will never know for sure. The other interesting thing about this gate, Geoffrey Chaucer, the early English writer, lived inside the gate during, I think, the 14th century. So we're now at our second gate, which is Bishop's Gate. You can see behind me the Heron Tower is more or less on the site of that old gate. This was the Roman road that led out towards East Anglia, and again, it's still die straight today. It's what we know now as Shoreditch High Street, Dalston, it goes on to Stoke Newington. We don't know who the bishop is that Bishop's Gate is named after. It's perhaps Erkenwald, who was this Anglo-Saxon figure who was very famous in the 7th century. Great thing about Bishop's Gate, it's the only London gate to be mentioned in a Beatles song, and I'll leave it with you to see if you can work out which song that was. We're now standing at Moorgate. Now, this was not one of the proper gates of the city in Roman times. This was very much a back door to the city, or a postern, to use the technical term. It was only built up as a major gateway in the medieval times. It led out into marshland called Moorfields, and those marshy lands were caused by the wall itself. Moorgate connects with London Wall, which we see down here. London Wall, of course, named after the ancient Roman wall. And today, again, it's becoming something of a wall. These modern buildings, London Wall Place, that are springing up as we speak, are giving the road a very characteristic enclosed feel to them. So once again, we see London Wall re-rising. Well, we're now at Cripplegate, probably the least known of London's gateways. Cripplegate also has this very evocative name. You think of cripples, people begging for money. That may well be the way the gate got its name. There was a kind of church and almshouse around here where cripples may well have come to beg. But it may also be from the Anglo-Saxon word cruple, which means a kind of subterranean vault or passageway that might have been in the area. Historians are divided. Like all the other gates, there's no remains here today. There is this nice plaque, though, which you'll find similar versions at most of the gates, and it tells you how to walk the Roman wall. And I invite you to come along anytime you like and walk this route. It's very clearly labelled on these maps. And get your own feel for the size and scope of the Roman city. Well, we're now on the site of Aldersgate, not to be confused with Oldgate, despite the similar name. Aldersgate is probably named after an Anglo-Saxon landowner, Mr. Alders or something like that. No one really knows, as with so many of these gate names. The name Aldersgate still survives today. If you go beyond the Museum of London back there, you'll be on the modern-day Aldersgate. And indeed, the Barbican Tube Station, which is just over that way, used to be known as Aldersgate Tube. Welcome to Newgate, and despite its name, it's just as old as all the other gates dating back to Roman times. Now, Newgate is quite a famous Roman gate, probably because of the jail which grew up here in the Middle Ages. Newgate Jail, it's just behind us now, the Old Bailey complex. And Newgate itself, the actual gate, did have prison cells within it, and that's where the old prison came from. And behind me, you might be able to see St. Sepulchre Church. Now, that's full name is St. Sepulchre Without Newgate. Without meaning outside the gate. So it all kind of fits together. We're on the site of the old gate, the church was without, and the prison is within. So here we are on Ludgate, one of the great famous entrances into London, and you can see why with St. Paul's at the top of the hill there. There are many explanations for where this name comes from. It may have been named after King Lud, an ancient king of London who may or may not have existed. Or Lud may have been a corruption of Floodgate, referring to the fact that the River Fleet is just down at the foot of the hill there. It may have flooded the area from time to time. Again, nobody really knows where the name comes from, but it's still a marvellous spot to finish our tour of the gates. So Rome and London had six gates, and we're at the first of them here, Old Gate. You can see the Church of Old Gate behind me. The gate was somewhere around this junction, which they're remodelling at the moment, so we can't see the precise spot. But this was the gate that led out of London towards Colchester, the important Roman town. And today it's still a very straight road, you know, Whitechapel Road, Mile End Road. You can still see it's Roman. This gate was called Old Gate, not because it was the oldest gate. People now think it was because it's the Ale Gate. There was some kind of hostelry, or what we'd now call a pub, outside the gate. And that's where the name Old Gate probably came from. They will never know for sure. The other interesting thing about this gate, Geoffrey Chaucer, the early English writer, lived inside the gate during, I think, the 14th century. So we're now at our second gate, which is Bishop's Gate. You can see behind me the Heron Tower is more or less on the site of that old gate. This was the Roman road that led out towards East Anglia, and again, it's still die straight today. It's what we know now as Shoreditch High Street, Dalston, it goes on to Stoke Newington. We don't know who the bishop is that Bishopsgate is named after. It's perhaps Erkenwald, who was this Anglo-Saxon figure who was very famous in the 7th century. Great thing about Bishopsgate, it's the only London gate to be mentioned in a Beatles song, and I'll leave it with you to see if you can work out which song that was. We're now standing at Moorgate. Now, this was not one of the proper gates of the city in Roman times. This was very much a back door to the city, or a postern, to use the technical term. It was only built up as a major gateway in the medieval times. It led out into marshland called Moorfields, and those marshy lands were caused by the wall itself. Moorgate connects with London Wall, which we see down here. London Wall, of course, named after the ancient Roman wall. And today, again, it's becoming something of a wall. These modern buildings, London Wall Place, that are springing up as we speak, are giving the road a very characteristic enclosed feel to them. So once again, we see London Wall re-rising. Well, we're now at Cripplegate, probably the least known of London's gateways. Cripplegate also has this very evocative name. You think of cripples, people begging for money. That may well be the way the gate got its name. There was a kind of church and almshouse around here where cripples may well have come to beg. But it may also be from the Anglo-Saxon word cruple, which means a kind of subterranean vault or passageway that might have been in the area. Historians are divided. Like all the other gates, there's no remains here today. There is this nice plaque, though, which you'll find similar versions at most of the gates, and it tells you how to walk the Roman wall. And I invite you to come along anytime you like and walk this route. It's very clearly labelled on these maps. And get your own feel for the size and scope of the Roman city. Well, we're now on the site of Aldersgate, not to be confused with Oldgate, despite the similar name. Aldersgate is probably named after an Anglo-Saxon landowner, Mr. Alders or something like that. No one really knows, as with so many of these gate names. The name Aldersgate still survives today. If you go beyond the Museum of London back there, you'll be on the modern-day Aldersgate. And indeed, the Barbican Tube Station, which is just over that way, used to be known as Aldersgate Tube. Welcome to Newgate, and despite its name, it's just as old as all the other gates dating back to Roman times. Now, Newgate is quite a famous Roman gate, probably because of the jail which grew up here in the Middle Ages. Newgate Jail, it's just behind us now, the Old Bailey complex. And Newgate itself, the actual gate, did have prison cells within it, and that's where the old prison came from. And behind me, you might be able to see St. Sepulchre Church. Now, that's full name is St. Sepulchre Without Newgate. Without meaning outside the gate. So it all kind of fits together. We're on the site of the old gate, the church was without, and the prison is within. So here we are on Ludgate, one of the great famous entrances into London, and you can see why with St. Paul's at the top of the hill there. There are many explanations for where this name comes from. It may have been named after King Lud, an ancient king of London who may or may not have existed. Or Lud may have been a corruption of Floodgate, referring to the fact that the River Fleet is just down at the foot of the hill there. It may have flooded the area from time to time. Again, nobody really knows where the name comes from, but it's still a marvellous spot to finish our tour of the gates.